Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In the days after the killing of George Floyd, protesters have made several demands to counter police violence and racism in the United States. Some of the demands directly relate to the history of race and violence in the nation, with a particular emphasis on the memory of the U.S. Civil War. In this program, contributing host Doug Becker explores the renewed campaign to remove racially offensive public memorials.
Campaigns against Confederate statues and memorials in the United States have marked much of the Trump presidency. In 2017, a city council decision to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, Virginia, led to violence and the killing of Heather Heyer. Since the murder of George Floyd, protests against racism have once again focused on these memorials, and several have been marked for removal. On today's show, I will discuss this development with Brent Sasley, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, Arlington. He is author of Politics of Israel and often writes on issues of emotional politics and memory. Brent, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, are you surprised that the focus of the protests have moved so quickly to this question of Confederate memorials? Has this caught you off guard, or is this something you kind of expected?
I wouldn't say that it's a surprise, given the nature of the protests, that they were very, very spontaneous. And in that sense, they grew very quickly and they expanded both in terms of the space where they were within a city, but then they expanded, of course, across the entire country. I believe all 50 states had some protests or had a protest of some kind. And it's not uncommon for protesters and for protests to zero in on some kind of public space. So we often talk about Tahrir Square in Egypt was the focal point of these protests. And the protests in Bahrain were at the Pearl Monument, which was this very large monument that consisted of six pillars and a pearl on the top. And it's not a coincidence that the protesters converged there and then that the government destroyed it to prevent that public space from being used. So I think protesters look for a place sometimes to gather, as in Tahrir Square, but also to focus their attention, their frustration, the despair, anger, their hope. And so it's not surprising that given that these Confederate monuments had been in the conversation, as you said, for a number of years, that they would then find these places, which are in the public space, and then focus their efforts on them. I'm not saying, I don't think it was pre-planned, but in that spontaneous or as these protests organically develop, it's not surprising that they then look to and found these monuments to then react to.
Yeah, and it strikes me with these protests that the role that history has played, the history of racism, the history of violence, that's been such a fundamental feature, that this is a set of protests that certainly exist in the present and they're about present day practices, but very quickly, organically, and perhaps naturally focused on the history of race relations. And that part of it I found particularly fascinating and sort of reinvigorating this. So how much do you see this as the perception that this is being placed in history as it's happening? This acknowledgement that this is part of an ongoing historical campaign and not just about 2020.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the whole underlying point of Black Lives Matter, of thinking about white privilege, of thinking about the whole development of the United States and it's the institutions of the United States, the social, political, economic ones. I mean, all of that is predicated on this sense that one group of people, i.e. whites, especially Christian whites, but it's expanded over time, have more inherent good qualities, they have more natural rights, God-given rights, and they simply just thought that that's the right way that the universe should be ordered against another group of people. I mean, we could talk about Black, Indigenous, people of color, but the protests are primarily focused on the Black community, that the Black community could not share because they didn't have those same God or natural rights, that they were not as human, they were subhuman, they didn't deserve them, and so on. And so you can't understand what these protests are about and what they're trying to achieve without understanding that they've been protesting this, as you said, this is American history. This is what they've been trying to change for hundreds of years. and what the white hegemonic group has been trying to maintain. And you can go back to the civil rights movement. You can go back even further to the Reconstruction era, the Civil War before. I mean, you know, there are clear moments and events in history that we can point to as kind of antecedents to this particular set of protests. But that's what it is. I mean, this is part of a historical process of trying to get justice between, or rather justice that means you don't have a separate group of people, whites and blacks, and the blacks have to be kept oppressed, that they can't share fully in the country. I mean, I think people, this I think is a mistake. I'm sure you probably had friends on Facebook and Twitter and other social media. Their first reaction to the protests has been looting is bad, destruction of property is bad. I mean, I think it's telling that that was their point of reference, not, oh, okay, so these protests are actually only the most recent that have emerged in this decade, centuries-long process of demanding equal justice. And yeah.
You mentioned the civil rights movement. So immediately what comes to mind, part of our research, you know, kind of shared interest I know we have is on individuals in history and how those narratives are advanced contemporaneously. So obviously the figure that has cast some of the greatest influence over the debates about what's the proper way to react to the killing of George Floyd is Dr. Martin Luther King, and being used as kind of almost a weapon, in particular by those who are critical of the violence. And for the record, violence against property is very different than violence against people. Right. And I think that needs to be stated. What are your thoughts about the way in which Dr. King's been used, really by both sides, but in particular by those critical of these protests, the famous, well, Martin Luther King would never approve of these.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. As we both, you know, as you mentioned, we both study this. I mean, there are monuments and educational curricula and festivals and days of commemoration. They don't just appear kind of exogenously. I mean, people specifically decide to create them for a very specific purpose. Mm-hmm. So if you want to understand these monuments, the Confederate monuments, or other things that we're looking at, you have to understand who created them and why. What kinds of groups did it? What were their goals and so on? I think with King, it's a little bit different. I think we're seeing a struggle over how to remember him. So the Confederate monuments that we're talking about, and I know you're working on this, so you can probably say more about this than I could, but the Confederate monuments were created in a particular period of time, decades after the Civil War ended, and they were created to promote a very particular view, not just of America, but of the South. And I think that those people who did that, those groups, they won that struggle over memory and identity and history, or at least they won it up until the last 10 years maybe or so, the last 5 years. With King, I think we're seeing a similar struggle play out over him as the man, but more than the man, as this iconic leader of, or one of, if not the leader of the civil rights movement, who managed to achieve what many whites would say is justice and equality, and therefore the story is finished and we don't have to go anymore. So for them, it's easy to look back and say, okay, King got what the black community needed. How did he do it? Oh, he did it by nonviolence, by simple, peaceful protests and so on. I mean, we know that that's actually not 100% accurate, that his strategy and his history was a lot more complicated than that. And so people who say, but, you know, Martin Luther King called for peaceful protests and that's the way to get change. Well, they're using him to impose their interpretation of King, the civil rights movement, of America today, of what America looks like today, and who is a good person and who is a bad person. And then they're applying that with a very broad brush to, quote, the protests, or, quote, the protesters, without, as you said, noting that, first of all, the damage that's being done by protesters is virtually only against property. Second, mm-hmm. It's mostly not the protesters who are doing it. We've actually seen evidence of right-wing groups coming and doing it. We've also seen evidence of some individuals just come and just kind of, you know, taking advantage of this moment and just causing damage. And then finally, there are some black protesters who are, this is the outlet that they feel that they have left to just express their despair and frustration after all of this. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot more, it's not just simple to say the protesters are bad, but I think some people are using King to make that argument.
And I think one of the more ironic points, this perception that I agree with that you had asserted, those arguing that what King accomplished, what the civil rights movement was meant to accomplish, so therefore, you know, peace and justice have all been achieved, was that one of the signature pieces of legislation was the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act specifically, that has been dismantled over the course of the last few years. This lack of awareness that the Supreme Court decision to dismantle federal oversight into determining voter rolls and different rules and regulations, you know, have led to things like the debates about the voter ID laws and voter purges. It is striking that that's not been a focus of the protests per se, which tells me that the protesters are growing a bit wary that the vote is the means by which to bring about this change, which is concerning as somebody who's obviously committed to democratic processes, though understandable.
Right.
But that part of this, that this is an ongoing historical argument, when the one thing that is probably perhaps the greatest accomplishment, legislative accomplishment of Martin Luther King and particularly, you know, his wing of the civil rights movement had accomplished, has been dismantled. Is it a coincidence that these protests are emerging at that time, or is it is there some part of causation? I'm literally asking because I'm kind of working for it myself.
I mean, it's a little bit out of my area, so I'm hesitant to draw firm conclusions. I do know that the Black community is many members, because there are different perceptions and ideologies and so on within the community. But many, first they see the Republican Party as a direct threat to them, as committed to not giving them full equality and justice, but that they're also a little bit, you know, okay, we vote Democrat, but the Democrats have taken advantage of us and they've ignored us. You know, they've marginalized us. They'll take our votes, but that's about all they'll do. So there is some leeriness, I think, associated with the voting process, that there hasn't been the kind of important change that the community would like to see coming out of the Democrats. And so that might be one answer. And I think it might also be that, so we are seeing some groups focusing now on the vote and getting the vote out and so on. I mean, Stacey Abrams, she's focused very much on that after her experience in Georgia, and also just what happened in the primaries, which I think is a direct outcome of what you noted, the kind of dismantling of the Voting Rights Act. What we saw in Georgia was directly out of that. I think that there, you know, right now the immediate concern is, look, we've waited so long. We've been telling you that things need to change. We're being killed by the system, and individuals who operate within it are killing us. We need change immediately now. We need to keep these protests up, because this is the way to do it. That operating within the democratic political arena isn't just, it's important and it's useful, but it's not what we need at this exact moment, that we need this extra parliamentary action to force people to make those changes in the legislative arena, which I think we see in other, I mean, we saw similar processes taking place in Israel and the Arab uprisings. I mean, that's why we have protests. It's a form of political communication that takes place outside that voting process. And it's designed to create conditions to change what happens when that voting process starts.
You mentioned about that this has taken place in other places. One of the things that's really striking to me about this movement and this period in history is how internationalized the response has been. There have been, you know, protests in several European cities, and even these memorials, you know, targeting spaces, you know, addressing questions like the slave trade, like in, I believe it was in London, the Queen Victoria statue, advocating that that be removed because of her role in the slave trade, but also broadly sort of racial issues, certainly across Europe, and you're seeing it, actually seeing it globally. I have to admit, that's been one of the biggest surprises to me, is how this uniquely, somewhat uniquely American issue has become internationalized so quickly.
That's really interesting. I mean, I know in the last year or two, people have been talking about the globalization of, in America, we call it the Trump phenomenon, but, you know, these right-wing populists, xenophobes and bigots that have kind of, it's not that they're not a direct kind of tight organization or coalition. It's kind of these loosely affiliated organizations. We see this in Brazil, in Great Britain, in the UK, parts of France, obviously in the United States. And you know, these kind of, these right-wing populists, parties and individuals who either win power or they manage to shape the public conversation. And that's really depressing. I mean, as someone who studies international relations, I mean, it's bad when you see it domestically, but knowing that there are these transnational links kind of makes it much harder to dislodge those kinds of ideas. So I think it's, I agree with you, it's kind of surprising how quickly it's gone global. The protests and these protests against racism and bigotry and discrimination, but it's hopeful because it might be a useful international global counterbalance to those global kind of loosely affiliated right-wing populist movements and ideas and individuals and institutions. So in that sense, I think it might be a good thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a reminder that even with so much cultural, you know, media consumption from all over the world, there's still so much attention. The world has so much attention on what's going on in the United States and this and our understanding that what we do in the United States is going to have this, you know, is going to have this global impact. One of the things that's really struck me is, again, how quickly some of these statues, it seemed like the statues were going to come down in Richmond, for example. Mm-hmm. I think it was either yesterday or 2 days ago, a judge did stay the governor's order to remove the statues. So, you know, kind of a quick reminder in the United States, mm-hmm. that as soon as you think something is happening quickly, usually the courts will come in and slow that down. Mm-hmm. But do you think something has changed? I mean, do you expect to see a lot more of these statues being removed than has been? Or do you think this is going to be one that, you know, certainly supporters of the statues or supporters of the status quo kind of sit on it, wait it out, hope that the protests peter out, and hope that whatever the next issue that's going to come up, seemingly every month there's a new one, maybe next month something else will come up and we'll forget about these?
It's an interesting question. Just to go back for a sec, it's interesting, you know, you pointed out the judicial system is now suddenly playing a role in these statues. I don't see why judges should have a say. I mean, in that decision to put up or not put up. I mean, these are either their private interests that have done it, dominating the public space, but the state can make that decision. It's not a judicial decision whether or not to remove it. It's up to the state. If these are public spaces, but that's a separate issue. I don't know. I feel like there has been a change and that things are, you know, kind of more permanent now, in the sense that, just as you said, look, it's not just monuments and statues, but look how quickly others have done this. I know, you know, many companies are being mocked or taken to account for suddenly discovering their white privilege or discovering racism, but they're putting out these statements saying Black Lives Matter and we're going to do what we can to make this a more just society. I think that represents a change. I mean, Lady Antebellum, I don't know if you saw it, changed their name to Lady A. I mean, that's NASCAR is now going to take away, or at least formally now says they're not going to fly the Confederate flag anymore. I mean, yeah, these things will probably take time to be implemented, and I'm sure they will be fought, and there might be setbacks and reversals, but it does seem like this is a moment where things have changed. I also do want to say, though, that I don't think we should think of these protests as spontaneous as they were, and the events that they were responding to, you know, the murder of George Floyd, as well as the more immediate murders of other Black people right before that. I mean, they're coming soon after the protests in Ferguson, and they're coming after the Women's March and the other marches that have taken place when Donald Trump was elected. And so there has been, over the last 5-7 years, kind of this culture of protest that helps, I think, lay the groundwork for public protest now as a vehicle for change. And so people have been primed. If we hadn't had all those protests before, I mean, obviously we can't play the what if game, but my feeling is that because these protests took place before and because they were about the same or similar issues, you had Charlottesville, I think people are more ready to say, okay, enough, mm-hmm. rather than had these protests been the first time we're seeing this kind of action against white privilege and systemic racism, then I think people might not have been so quick to react. but we've been ready for this now. We've had multiple moments where we can now say, I'm saying this without judgment. I'm not saying it's time. I'm just saying that people and institutions and society is more ready now to say, okay, fine, it's enough now, because they've been kind of more, I mean, they've been intermittent, but sustained over the last 5 to 7 years. So I think that probably put all together gives us a sense of hope that, yes, that change is more likely to be permanent.
An interesting development with that. And I agree with you there that for a number of people, I think the sense is, you know, why have we not started to resolve this? This has been going on and going on and going on. And so, I mean, activists who've been protesting are saying, you know, certainly enough is enough, but, you know, we've been here, we've been doing this. I think for a lot of people who generally hadn't tuned in as much to these protests, there's this sense that, okay, maybe we've finally gotten to the point where it's time to address this, because we know that if we don't, mm-hmm. we're going to be right back in this moment the next time that there's, next time a police officer kills a Black person, and that this sort of, you know, this expectation. That being said, it seems like one of the great interesting questions is this going to play out as a partisan issue? Because certainly Democrats, current office holders, people running for office, are citing these as examples, you know, citing these as campaign issues, though they're complicated, certainly with things like the campaign to defund the police is not something that the party is embracing. Republicans really are, I've been watching the Republicans pretty closely here, because certainly the president's inclination is to simply reject all these movements. Even things that seem relatively reasonable, like renaming, you know, Army barracks and Marine Corps barracks, renaming them so they no longer represent Confederate leaders. The president has pushed back on that. He's chosen to hold his next big rally in Tulsa, this site that, and we all know from a pop culture reference about the Tulsa race riots, on June the 19th or Juneteenth. You know, I've come to the conclusion these are never coincidental when it comes to the president and the campaign, that he seems to be indicating that he wants to fight on this issue and push back. Other Republicans, Tim Scott, for example, seems to indicate, you know, there may need to be some way to address these questions that's maybe a uniquely Republican way. So you think this is going to be a partisan issue? Is the party going to fall in line with what the president, you know, the president, the reaction against this seems to be, you know, where it's being driven? Or is there going to be any area of consensus?
I think the short answer is I'm not totally sure. But I would say two things. First, I think it depends on the issue. So I can't recall his name, but the Republican chair of the Senate Armed Forces Committee, or the Senate, I forget the name of the committee, but the Republican, and I forget his name too, but the Republican chair agreed with the ranking Democratic member that it's time to rename these bases, that they shouldn't be after Confederate soldiers and military leaders, but after real American heroes, those who didn't commit treason and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think we might see consensus around some of those issues. But I think the broader concern among many Republicans is that they really are afraid that they're going to lose both houses and the presidency. And so they're torn between what some of them might think is the right thing to do and, you know, giving up on Trump, which would be bad for them politically, both individually and as a party. And I think that you might see some Republicans struggling with that. I also think, though, that, you know, this is taking place at the end of Trump's first term. Had these protests taken place at the beginning, I suspect we would have seen more Republican support for Trump and his use of the military against peaceful protests and you know, his embracing of these racist imagery and ideas and dates and so on. But it's at the end. And we've had 4 years of his incompetence, his purpose, you know, his bigotry, his misogyny, his lack of interest, his terrible policies. I think people, including among many conservatives, have now seen, in a sense, they've had enough. And that's on top of the pandemic, which he has clearly bungled and had no interest in actually handling. I mean, it's not so much that he bungled it, it's just that he just didn't care enough to do something about it. And even when he did, it was just mostly to make policy statements without actually following through. So all of these things are happening now at the same time. I think that that's a clear context that we need to keep in mind. I will say, I think the other thing that is important that, again, American politics is a little bit out of my area, but the fact that we have so much video evidence of how police have acted toward the media and protesters, especially Black protesters, I mean, that's just so unavoidable, and there's just not an argument. There's no argument against that. Not all police, but some police who have committed these acts of violence very clearly were violent, attacking the media and unprovoked. They were attacking protesters and beating them and like lashing out at them. It's hard to deny that. I mean, it's incontrovertible, and there's no way to dance around it. So I think that that is making it harder for Republicans to do what they might have done at the beginning of Trump's term had the context been different.
Well, here's to hoping that if nothing else, there's going to be some sort of fundamental change, you know, some sort of change, because at least we're talking about change. And these are certainly going to be this ongoing political drama to see if this change actually happens.
I was going to say, for us as professors, as academics, I think one other positive thing in what you were talking about is I think we are likely to see changes in the academy, and there'll be a lot more questions about how especially white professors teach and how we accommodate Black students and how we make ourselves and our universities and our departments aware of white privilege and what it means. I think that's a positive thing. I'm not saying it'll be an easy and an immediate change, but you're talking about positive change. I think that will be a positive one.
And I'll end with the observation that the building I teach in at the University of Southern California, they have removed the name of that building. It's something we've all kind of known about, that this was a past president of the university that infamously had used eugenics as a basis for his research. And so I know at least in one very specific example, I'm currently now teaching in a building that has no name. We'll see if it has a name by the time the semester begins. Yeah, thank you very much, Brent Sasson, and obviously continue to have these conversations.
Always a pleasure.